Can you introduce yourself to listeners?
My name is Amir Lokir-Beletsky. I'm a PhD student in Guelph. I'm an Israeli citizen and Israeli by birth. In the summer of the year 2002, I refused what you call here deployment, or I refused an order by my superiors in my combat unit to go and serve in the occupied territories. I was a soldier. I served in the Israeli army for 3 years as a regular soldier, and I served reserved in a tank unit. I was a combat soldier. I mean, I was a good Israeli boy, as you're supposed to be in Israel. And in this step, I sort of crossed the boundaries and became, for most Israelis, something between a curiosity to a traitor. Much more to the traitor side than the curiosity side. Ever since then, I'm talking about the age of 27, so I'm 36, 37 almost, for the last decade, basically, I'm active, especially in the connection between the Israeli society and the Israeli military. Also, I was connected to one refusnik group called Courage to Refuse, which still exists on a lower level in Israel today. And I supported, as much as I humbly could, every struggle that the Israeli radical left outside of Zionism, and we'll talk about it a little bit, conducted in the last decade. As I think my refusing to go to the territories and other groups that refuse either to serve completely in the army and enlist, Israel has a conscription law that everybody at 18 has to enlist into the army, and there were other groups that refused conscription altogether on the grounds not because they are pacifist and they are against army in general, but because the army is an occupying army. And as an occupying army, they won't serve in it. And they, of course, were punished much more than me. Usually Israeli society punishes those who refuse. Punishment would be, first of all, the military. The military, of course, has its own laws. So I went into trial under those laws, and I spent in jail twice, each time for a period of roughly a month. Other groups, usually the youngers, we are reserves, so we are some sort of, older soldiers, but the young conscript that refused used to be, are punished much more. The army usually uses a method of reoccurring incarceration. Those guys coming into the induction center, they are getting into a court-martial, are sentenced, let's say, to 20 to 30 days. And when they get out, they once again go to introduction center after a few days, let's say a week in. And once again, they refuse. And once again, they are incarcerated. The army, at least at some stages, thought that this would break them. But since those guys and quite recently girls also serve in the army, of course, in Israel, wouldn't be broken off, the army usually decided to release them and finish the whole thing and get over the embarrassment altogether. As for now, I've seen a few emails. I'm living in Canada for the last 3 years, so I'm not exactly with my hand on the pulse all the time, but I've seen a few cases of refuseniks. There is a network of support for them, both in Israel and outside Israel, by the way. But those cases are becoming few apart. Maybe there will be another wave of refuseniks.
What kind of experiences lead people to refuse
deployment?
First of
all, there is the personal experience. My case, and I'm talking about myself, I'm not talking about the 18-year-olds that refuse induction altogether.
Right.
In my case, I when I signed the letter of refusing, the public letter that every refusenik groups is doing, it's sort of an Israeli tradition, you send the letter to the Prime Minister and the Ministry of Defense, which are basically the two most powerful people in Israel. And you proclaim, it's a public letter that you send into newspaper, and you proclaim, this is the things I won't do, and this is why I won't do them. We said in this letter, as a collective, that we are more than willing, as soldiers, to defend Israel against its enemies. We do understand that you need an army, and not everybody likes Israel. Okay, we can understand that, but the order to go to serve in the territories, according to our experience, because we've been there and we served there, it's not something that we don't know out of our experience, It's not stories that we heard. It's things that we've done. This is not moral. This is not Jewish. And remember, this is a Jewish state. It's not Jewish. It's not moral. It's against the core of our beliefs and against our conscience. And you can put us in any, you know, any mission or any mission that would defend Israel, really. And we were more than willing to do that. But this order we cannot obey. Despite the fact that it's legal and it was issued by a democratically elected government, mm-hmm. We are willing to, you know, serve the time and be punished for it, because at the end we're living in a democracy, or with all its flaws, it's still a democracy. And as a democracy, we are willing to do the time for the sort of crime. And I think those were, in that moment when we did that, us courage to refuse, us the refuseniks then, it was a moment that it was needed to be done. And why? In 2000, the second Intifada started, and there is an immediate escalation of the Palestinian-Israeli or Palestinian-Zionist conflict. And it's much worse than it ever was. The violence, both sides, of course, the Palestinians with their terror and us with our F-16s and executions of, you know, of prominent Palestinians. Everything escalated. And we were called as soldier in the army, as reservists, to go and basically implement this new war. And I remember that personally, the last time I've been in the territories was in 2001. And they sent us to a place near Jerusalem. And for the first time, I looked at the checkpoints that I was manning as a soldier. And I looked, we were in a place near Jerusalem, which it's highly concentrated by settlers. It's called Gush Etzion. Check on the map if you want. Gush Etzion, there's a whole story there of a Jewish settlement that was there before 48 and was taken by the Jordanian Legion, the Jordanian army in 48. And Jews, it was one of the first settlements straight after 67 that was settled by usually ultra-religious Zionist Jews,
mm-hmm.
which have now a lot of clout in Israeli society, more than they used to be. Anyway, we were there, and I noticed for the first time, both logically and emotionally, that I'm not defending the state of Israel. That I'm not defending the borders against the Syrian army that is on the fences. I'm not sitting in my tank and, you know, and defending home and family, as I was told I'm supposed to do. I'm not even fighting terrorism, because I don't understand how a checkpoint that chokes a village from getting its water, its basic needs, how this kind of checkpoint defends Israelis from terrorism.
Were there a lot of people thinking this way that
no.
you knew?
Okay. No. The army, Israeli army is sort of, despite the declining numbers of people, you know, going into the army, because Israel is becoming sort of a liberal Western society much more than it used to be, the army still reflects society in many ways. And in my own unit, there were people that thought about staying in the territories like me. They were generally on the left.
Mm-hmm.
But to cross the line and refuse an order and pay the price for it. And remember, it's a military unit. Those are people that I spent a few years together. I've seen them every year. They are my friends. Some of them, you know, in the army you make friendship very, very, very fast. They are my friends. Those are guys, older guys like me. They have the same worries. You talk about your kids. You drink coffee together. Those days, at least, I smoke with them together. So there is this camaraderie. And I, believe me, when I refused, I felt very guilty, because those guys were going into what I know was a war.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that they can get hurt. Whatever I think about what they're doing is wrong, those are my friends. And I remember it really concerned me. The second time, I wasn't part of any organic unit, so I didn't mind that much. I wasn't connected to people. I just came in and, you know, I refused and went to jail. And that was,
wow.
It was almost, you know, almost administrative.
Can you talk about that experience of refusing and what happened?
What happens?
What happens when you refuse?
I'll talk about the first time, because the second time was half a mistake of the army. And
Really?
Sort of. Somebody didn't talk with anybody. The Israeli army is, is like Israeli society, very unorderly and slightly corrupt. You know, it's not Africa corruption, but it's corruption.
Okay.
The first time I refused, I called my captain and told him, look, I'm not going to come with you this time. I'm going to refuse. And very quickly he said to me, look, I don't want to handle it. I'm transferring you to something equivalent of a colonel, the regiment commander, which was, of course, the complete opposite for me, a settler, religious settler, a very right-wing. I mean, we are talking about really the extreme right.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to my house in Tel Aviv, and we sat down, I remember, in the public park. I didn't have children yet, so I could stay out of the house as much as I want.
Mm-hmm.
Delete that. So we sat down at the public park and we talked, and he tried to convince me not to do it. He said, look, I'll give you all sorts of options. I mean, he says, it's not the first time. It's not the first time I'm, you know, I'm encountering a soldier like you that doesn't want to go. He said, what if you'll come to serve, but you won't have any connection with the Palestinian population, so well, your sensibilities won't be offended.
He actually asked you like that?
No, it's options that are presented to you, and some soldiers...
And explained that as the reason, so that you wouldn't be
As
sensitive?
Yeah. So because it's, you know, it's my personal problems, I don't want to see those things. I don't want to do them personally, but you can serve, but not serve.
Mm-hmm.
And I politely said no. And basically, this is the only option that he could give me. And we went into the politics of it. And he said to me, look, during the Oslo Agreement at the 1990s, I didn't agree with the government completely. I mean, I thought the government is doing something terrible. They are going to take territories out of the Holy Land and give them to the enemies of Israel, which is... For him, it's you know, it's breaking the command of God, the divine command. And I said, and still I didn't refuse. And I said, with all due respect, this kind of not refusing or refusing is not at the same level as I am, because I'm refusing out of humanist and I think Jewish, in my own interpretation, Jewish motives, which are, you know, don't do to thy friend what you don't want to do to yourself. And, you know, refusing to participate in acts that... participate in acts that are going to be against humanity, basically, like the right wing is preaching, like the Israeli right is preaching, is not the same refusnik as I am. And then we talked about the politics. I was, you know, I didn't try to get him... too much, you know, heated, or to get into too much of a heated discussion, because, you know, I didn't want to stay in jail too long. At the end, he understood that that's not going to work. I'm steadfast, and I'm going to refuse anyway. And I came into the where you inducted into reserve, into the army. I must tell you, it's a terrible feeling. I mean, you sit there with a bunch of people that every year you meet. And you know personally, and they're all getting ready, and there's a habit into it. There's you know, this is the order, this is the natural order of things. You go once a year and you go into the army, and it's, you know, it's a little bit of fun because it's friends, and you're outside of your regular routine, and you're outside of, you know, of work and civilian life. And for the first time I felt alienated, and for the first time I felt I'm not part of it. And I think this is the first time my old identity as an Israeli, as a combat soldier on the front lines, as somebody that always serves, it's very important for a young Israeli. Maybe it's, you know, the macho feeling broke down. And I understood I'm outside, I'm over the pale, that's it. And then there was a court-martial in front of the division commander, and I was stupid enough to say... that, like Luther, this is where I stand and I'm not gonna move. And of course, he stuck me for a month in jail, the longest that he could.
And the second time you were in jail?
The second time, really, was, I must say, I came, the trial was half funny, because I quoted a philosopher, and then the guy that, I think he was a quartermaster of some kind, some low-ranking, quite nice officer that, you know, that court-martialed me. He apparently learned philosophy, so we quoted philosopher, went to each other. I quoted an historian, he quoted a philosopher.
He was ready.
He wasn't ready, but he knew a few things. So it became half jokingly, half a joke. And he sentenced me to 28 days that became 21 days because all sorts of bureaucracy and everything. So I stayed a few days at home.
This was the second time.
This was the second
time. And so how long was that after?
I spent, in total, I think 50 days in jail with breaks of a year or two between them. Mm. The first time, I think, was much more meaningful, both publicly, because we were the public eye, at least when I started to go, when the first time I went to jail. There was the highest number of refuseniks in jail at that time in the history of the state.
Did you get a sense of the people, their experiences that led them to refuse deployment as an Israeli defense force member? Yeah.
I must tell you that, you know, the collective experience is pretty much the same. People went into the territories, and the eyes, basically, it's, you know, it's an existential experience that your eyes are opened. And for the first time, you see that there is a discrepancy between saying you're a democratic country and you are working according to international laws and what is going. And you have to understand, it's not light years away. I served in places that were an hour and a half from where I live. And I lived in Tel Aviv in the middle of, you know, of Western, very rich Israel. And then I went into the outskirts of somewhere in the West Bank. And you see people basically living in abject poverty, under occupation, with terrible violation of human rights, humiliated, which is, I think, it's the most terrible crime we commit, the humiliation of people in front of their families. And in basically in a state of continual war, which in many cases we are the one to be blamed on. And all the time we are defending not a state, not our families, not our daughters, not our sons, not our wives. No, we are defending an apartheid system where a few privileged settlers, just because they are Jews, are entitled for the cream of the land and the masses of slaves, and there's no other way to describe it. The masses of slaves are there either to be killed, slaughtered, or serve them. At times giving, you know, some sort of a Bantustan, that's really an apartheid term, some sort of a Bantustan, maybe it will keep them quiet.
Okay.
And time after time, Israelis learn, not because of morality, but because it hits them brutally, that they can't do it anymore. That there is consequences to this apartheid, to this system. And the consequences, we've seen it in the streets. It's the terror, it's the fact that that Israeli society is much more brutal and much more aggressive than it used to be. It has results.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to expand more on the analogy of Israel apartheid, where that comes from, like the similarities between that and South African apartheid?
Okay, first of all, I'm not an expert about South African apartheid, and I didn't do the research needed.
That's okay.
If you ask me, my opinion is, in Israel, there's apartheid in South Africa was enacted into law. It was there to everybody to see. And in that sense, it was transparent. You could see it. Israeli apartheid is not enacted into law. It's unofficial. And that's the main difference on the one hand. On the other hand, there are many features which are similar and dissimilar. First of all, we have a settler population, just like in South Africa. The Dutch white settlers that came in the 17th century, as much as I remember. But in South Africa, things were a little bit different because the white minority became African, became part of the land. And the solution was, how did they call it very beautifully, a rainbow nation. And there was a Nelson Mandela to solve the whole thing so miraculously. But in Israel, basically, I think the apartheid is hidden under the carpet. Most Israelis prefer to turn their back. But you have a lot of features which are very similar, like Jews-only highways in the territories. The segregation by a fence of, you know, the two populations of Israelis and Palestinians, the carving and the stealing of territories of the Palestinian homeland. And when you go down deeper into 48 and even before 48, basically we have a European settlers population that came into this land and carved to itself, sometimes by force, sometimes by, usually by buying and persuasion or coercion, based on a colonial country, which was Britain, carved itself its own land. I'm not saying that Israelis don't have, or Jews don't have, the right for self-determination. They have a right to self-determination. Israel is a nation. Jews have the features of a nation. We are talking about a nation with self-determination and, you know, a validity by itself. I can criticize as much as I like, and most of my criticism will be true, the way it was created, but those are undeniable facts. And I don't think most Palestinians today, despite the past, would say that Israel doesn't have a right to exist. But on the other hand, Palestinians have the right to exist in their own state, or whatever way they would choose to show their self-determination. And this is what Israel is systematically denies. And in many cases, what Israel is performing in the occupied territories, and it's not a genocide, but it's a politicide. It's the murdering of the political expression of Palestinians. It's murdering the possibility of Palestinians to form their own institutions, to form their own independent state. You know, it's a brutal process. And I think the end result on the part of Israel would be is some sort of a subdued excuse or fig leaf of a state in what would left out of Palestine, basically reservations for the natives, sort of, with a complete supremacy both economically and politically and militarily of Israel. And this is would be the end of the conflict, as, you know, the Israeli military and political elite sees it. But reality always, you know, when they try to promote this kind of a solution, the disengagement in 2005, and even Oslo, when they try to promote this kind of solution, it doesn't work. It doesn't work because the Palestinians don't get it. They don't get the fact that they are supposed to be slaves. They don't get the fact that they are supposed to be subdued. And they react, and they revolt. And at least in the... I can question some of the methods, but I can't question the validity and the inherent rightfulness of this kind of revolt, of this kind of struggle.